My name is Russ, and I'm an alcoholic. I belong to the Sole Purpose Group in Montgomery, Alabama. My sobriety date is May the 26th, 1974. And I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate having everybody here. There was a note that was handed to me that I was supposed to share. I think that the voice forgot to mention that. And it said that in case of fire, we ask all Al-Anons to remain seated until the AAs have cleared the building. Don't know what happened on that one. That's terrible. Somebody once told me, I think when I was on the convention out to Miami State last year, that an Al-Anon came up and was pretty incensed with that, said, you know, if you want to build up an organization, don't tear them down. And I said, well, you know, I make mistakes from now on. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to be here on Sundays. Ordinarily, at this point, I'd have my fancy gowns on. Nice and white, and those beautiful stoles being lented, being a very purple one, little cincture on the, around the middle and so forth, and I'd be standing up in a pulpit someplace delivering a sermon. I retired from the active ministry in 1990, and since that time, well, I've been doing other things like running a treatment program for intensive outpatient for chemical dependency, and I really love that. I wanted to mention a couple of things because I heard some of the previous speakers talk about kids and family, and I have 8 children, you know, which shows that preachers do more than just talk on Sunday morning, I'll tell you that. Yeah. And I also have 25 grandchildren, and I have 1 great-grandchild and another one in the oven. So I have a wonderful support group in my recovery, even though a lot of them have never seen their grandfather or drunk or anything like that. I have 1 of my children who never saw me drunk, and I'm real happy for that. Something has happened to me, and I can't start sharing anything with you without telling you, first of all, how grateful I am. I've learned a long time ago that when I go to bed grateful at night, that's the way I wake up. You don't lose that overnight because it's a precious, priceless gift that God has given to all of us in this program. I remember reading a little story about an old drunk one time who just kept getting drunk, and his family didn't know what to do with him, and they finally decided that they would take some action. And when he came home on this particular occasion, he was drunk as usual. He passed out on the couch. They took him out and stuck him in a station wagon, took him out to the local cemetery, dug a hole, and buried him with only his head sticking out. And the next morning, you know, the sun was up and the birds were chirping, and the old drunk woke up and he said, "My God, it's Resurrection Day, and I'm the first one up." You know, and that's basically a lot of the crazy attitudes that we have as far as life is concerned. I read about some preachers that were gambling at one time, and they got caught in this small town, and they were hauled before the magistrate the next day, and the magistrate asked the Catholic priest, "Were you gambling?" And he fumbled his beads, you know, and he said Hail Mary and stuff like that, and he said, "No, sir, I was not gambling." And he asked the Methodist preacher, said, "Were you gambling, Reverend?" He said, "No, sir, I don't do anything like that. I know that Jesus died for my sins, and therefore it's forgiven too, before even it." And he turned to the Jewish rabbi, and he said, "Were you gambling, Rabbi?" He said, "With whom?" And, you know, that's kind of the approach that I took with life and with alcohol and things like that. It's pretty miserable to realize that alcohol can so take you down the tube that you lose everything that's of any value to you whatsoever. I'm big on the happy, joyous, and free thing. I'm a happy person today because I hang around with happy people. And I'm happy because I hang around with a program that promotes happiness. I also am very joyful, and I believe that joy to me is a state of being, it's a condition that's been given to me. And I know that no matter what, and I heard Michael talk about that briefly last night, I know that no matter what, it's going to be okay. Because there's a power greater than myself who's going to be there to help me. And I also believe that today I am free. And I am free to become the kind of person that my Creator intended me to be. And that has required hard work, and for that I am very grateful, and I thank all of you and the people I've met over the years for helping me to come to that point. I live by a simple approach to life today, and that is seeking to care and daring to give. Before I die, I will finally live. And I believe that's what happened, the transformation that took place in Russ Killian, who is an alcoholic. I am a member of the Alcohol of Fame, and I have all the characteristics of the alcoholic, very immature, very insecure as I was growing up, very hypersensitive, wearing my feelings on my sleeves all the time, a pig for recognition, never feeling that I really amounted to much or that I even had much to offer to this world. And that's basically the way that I live. And I can remember that as a little child, I felt like I wasn't really much of anything. My father was a very heavy drinker. And as a result of that, my relationship with him, you know, had suffered a great deal. I was made to feel, or allowed myself to feel, that I was really the little pimply kid who really had nothing to offer in life. And I felt at the time that I want to do something when I get older where I had some power. I went into the army and did a lot of drinking when I was over there. They said, if you want to be a man, you have to drink, so I did. And when I came home, I quit drinking completely. I stopped that because my mother was a teetotaler, and she didn't like the idea of my going to church and then going to the tavern and sitting there and getting drunk. I felt that I was lacking in a lot of things, but I said, someday I'm going to have a position where I had power. I got into the ministry, and let me tell you, if you want power, you got it. You have power over the lives of people. People trust you, they look up to you, they adore you, they honor you, they respect you, and you can do just about anything that you want. At least that's what I found. I drank and continued to do so, and what I found out was that some strange things were beginning to happen in my life. Things that were out of the ordinary. For instance, I would start cutting the meeting short and said, you know, I don't believe that God wants us to work this hard. We need to get home and get some rest. So I'd go home and get the rest of the booze and take care of that. As a minister, I could get first draft communion wine. Now, the rest of you can't do that. But I could. And we're not talking this little Mickey Mouse stuff that you get in the stores, you know, with the sugar added to it and the coloring and things like this. This is powerful stuff, 27%, 28%. And I would buy it by the gallons, by the cases, and put it in little bottles and hide it behind the Bibles in the office and places like that. And every time I wanted to get religious and read the scriptures, I'd pull that out and have a little snort, put the Bible back, and things were doing pretty good. I remember one night that my work began to be affected. There was a young lady who called about 12:30 one night, and she said, you know, I'm going to commit suicide. And I thought, well, you don't want to do that. And she said, are you going to come and talk to me? I said, oh, yeah, I'll be there. So I hung up, and I laid back down and went to sleep. And the phone rang again, and she said, aren't you coming? And I said, well, yes, I'll be there. I just couldn't find my shoes. I don't know what happened to them. And I laid back down and fell asleep. And she called a third time and she said, you know, I don't think you really are interested at all. And she hung up. I never have to this day found out whether or not anything happened with that young lady. But my alcohol had got me to the point that I really didn't pay much attention to anything like that. My relationship to my wife began to go downhill, and incidentally, I used to call her a psycho bitch. Because, I mean, this woman could really complain, and she could gripe, and she could come at me, and so forth and so on. I gave money to the kids. I took booze with me to the pastor's conferences. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing more boring than sitting around all day listening to a bunch of preachers talking. So I would take my booze with me, and I would go to the room, and I'd ask them, y'all want to come up and have a drink? And they'd say, what's the matter with you? What are you doing with this stuff here? I said, well, you know, a guy's got to relax once in a while. I have a tough life. I mean, trying to take care of people is a full-time job. And they didn't quite understand that. I had a schedule for buying my liquor. 5 little towns around the area where I lived. I always wore my collar. Because that collar got me into places and it got me things you couldn't get otherwise. I always made a point to find out where the liquor stores were run by Catholics. Because they recognize that collar, you know. And I'd walk in the door and they'd say, hello, Father. And I would say, well, how do you do? I said, you know, the bishop is coming, the Monsignor is going to be here, we're having a little party, and we'd appreciate, you know, if we give us a little break on the price here. So I manipulate them down and get all kinds of booze for cheap. I learned, too, that I could use God as an excuse to do all kinds of things. I remember I'd go to the restaurants particularly, and that was always a really good relief for me to get out of the business for a while. And I'd go there and watch these normal people come in, and they'd sit down and they'd have a drink, and you'd watch them. They'd just daintily sip the wine, and then they'd get up and leave. And I saw many of a drink that was left. I told the waiter, said, come here a minute. I said, do you realize what kind of people they are? They are taking one of the greatest gifts that God has given us, the gift of booze, and look what they're doing with it. They left it here. Bring that over here. So I'd get a lot of good booze that way and things like that. Okay? Baptisms. I would do baptisms, and a lot of times I was drunk when I did that, and I'd take the little baptismal shell and fill it full of water and dump it all over the kid. You know, miss the head and everything else where you're supposed to do that. I finally got to the point that things bothered me to the extent that I wasn't sure what was going on. I was so drunk most of the time. But you see, I had a lot of help. I had a Christian day school. I had vicars that came. And whenever I didn't want to do something, I'd just turn it over to them. And I would just disappear from the scene. But I remember that things got really tense in my home. And one morning, the district president of my church body shows up at the door. And Barbara said, President Hoppel's here to talk to you. I said, what for? She said, oh, did I forget to tell you that I called him and told him everything that's going on, and he's going to nail your butt to the wall. And I thought to myself, what kind of a wife is this? You know. Anyhow, President Hoppel did come. And we sat in the east room of the parsonage, which I had built on because the others were too small. And we talked about this and about that. And the upshot of that whole meeting was that we prayed for Barbara and he went back to Chicago. Yeah. So, pretty good, huh? But then things got worse. And I remember one time I did a wedding in Arlington Heights, which is about 60 miles from where I was. It was in an Episcopal church there. I'm a Lutheran, but anyhow, they got married there. And I remember that they had a little pond out in the courtyard. This was in February, in the middle of a blizzard. I fell in the pond. I don't know what happened there. But I got up, and I remember that I wring out the bottom of the gown and everything, tried to shake it loose here as much as possible. And I got up and completed the wedding. Afterwards, we went to the reception. Of course, I got drunk as usual. And Barbara went out in the car and she cried. And she came in about 2 o'clock and she said, you know, we need to go home because you have to preach tomorrow morning. I said, you know, you don't know how to have a good time, bitch. Leave me alone. Get out of my life. So the upside of the thing was we got in the car. I was driving. She said, I want to drive home. I do not want our children to be orphans. And I said, you're not driving my car. And she said, well, if you don't let me drive this car, I'm getting out. I said, okay, bitch, open the door, let her out. 60 miles from home in a blizzard. I went home and went to bed. Some people from the church eventually came and picked her up. And on the way home, she told them everything I ever did. When they got there, guess what? My car was there at the house. And they said, if he was as drunk as you said he was, he could never have gotten home in this kind of weather. So once again, you know, I had my enablers, and then this church that I had 1,800 people in it, so they all enabled me, and they loved me, and they took care of me, and they did all kinds of things. But behind the scenes, some pretty miserable things were happening. And I guess the culmination of all of it was that one time, to show you how crazy things did get, that in our church we use wine and wafers for communion, and the people come up and they kneel at the railing there. And there's one lady who was rather booksome who came up there, and I remember that I went there and the wafer dropped down in her thing. And I thought to myself, my gosh, what am I going to do? So I just went in and got it and brought it back out. And I, you know, I told her afterwards that I hope that didn't bother you, you know, because you know, we believe that this is part of the Lord's celebration here today. And but I got to tell you, one of the culminations of stuff that was really happening. I was a wild preacher, I'm telling you, when I drank. But one of the things that was that really happened, I think that was terrible. And to this day, I still remember that, and I'm not proud of that, but it did happen. One Saturday morning, I remember I was lying at home on the floor with my collar on, not bothering anybody, and my wife came up and she kicked me right in the ribs, and she said, "Get up, you're sick, we're going to the hospital." So I got in the car. They took me over to the Swedish American Hospital in Rockford, Illinois, walked in the door, she talked to the lady at the information desk, "Four, please." Well, I knew the fourth floor was a psycho ward. This woman was going to put me away. She thought that I was sick, that I had some real problems. We went up to the fourth floor, and we went into Dr. Henry's office. I knew him because I met him before when I visited some of my people there. And we sat down, and guess what? He said, "Barbara, you seem to be excited. What's going on here?" So she proceeded to tell him everything I ever did. "He's destroying our home. He's ruining the lives of the children. He's destroying the church. And look at him. He can't even stay awake half the time." 35 minutes later, she stopped. And he looked at me and he said, "Reverend Killian, what do you have to say about all this?" And I just sat up in my chair and got my best clergy voice on. And I said, "Well, Dr. Henry, I'm really concerned about Barbara. She's been acting like this for the last 4 or 5 years, and the people in our church think that she is really cracking up." And the result of the whole thing was that he kept her there. Yeah. Yeah. He kept her there for 30 days. And being the good alcoholic that I am during that time, I got a hold of the people that were important in the church. And I told them, I said, "You know, the cheese slipped off her cracker here. And this woman is rowing with one oar these days, so that when she comes out and gets out, I want you to love her and respect her and be kind to her. But don't believe a word she tells you, because she's lying again." I have had to live with that. For all of these years, this woman had never hurt me. She's a wonderful mother, a wonderful wife, a wonderful pastor's wife, and everything else, you see. But I say that, and I share that simply because it tells me something, that alcohol and the power of alcohol and the power of addiction had that kind of power over me, that I was willing to sacrifice anything or anyone who got in the way. And she was a threat to my drinking, so she had to go. Now, we worked through that a little bit later, but we'll get to that eventually. The result of the whole thing was that I came to the point that my life was so messed up that I didn't know what to do. I was always feeling guilty. I had this shame. I had this sense of helplessness, hopelessness. God, where do I go with this thing? What am I going to do? How am I ever going to make things? And I began to spend all my time just living on the edge. And our relationship got worse. We used to sit there in the East Room at night. I'd come home, and she'd smoke at me, I'd drink at her. Back and forth we go. Now, like that one, you like that one? And back and forth. But see, she always knew when to quit, I never did. And so I'd end up falling down the basement steps, you know, or ending out in the backyard some night, not exactly sure what the heck is going to happen. I lived on the edge, and the result was that I was bent on self-destruction and doing a great job at it. I began to live with the four horsemen mentioned last night, the despair, the terror, the frustration, and the bewilderment, and I could not understand, why are you doing this? Why are you acting like this? What kind of example is this, you know, you're going to set for your kids and so forth? So I finally came to what is described for us in the big book, to that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization of my life. And when you're at that point, you know, what is there left? So I talked to God. And incidentally, I knew all about God. I knew all about Him. And I could sit down with anybody and take the Bible, and we could have a big discussion, and I could teach you something. That's how smart I was. But you know what the problem was? I didn't know him. I just knew all about him. And later on, things began to come to place. And I would try to deal with God, and I'd say, later, God. You know, later, God, I'll take care of this. So this old preacher who was loved and who had been revered and honored and cared for by the people had turned into nothing but an old drunk who didn't know what life was all about at all. So, but I wanted help, but I did it on my terms. I was going to be right, but I'd do it my way. You see, I was too important to change, and what you're going to see through all of this is that this guy had an ego way out of proportion, arrogant, know-it-all, nobody can tell me what to do, you mess with me, I'll do you in, you can't get away with anything, I'm running the show, I got the power that I wanted when I was a kid, and I didn't know what to do with it. I was the king, and the king does not fall, he just rules. But anyhow, some terrible things happened. I wanted to quit. I could not quit. I tried to quit. I said, I can handle this, and I found out that I really couldn't. So I did the only thing that made sense to me at the time, and I ran away. I left everything. One morning, got up, rented a car from the local dealer, and I took off. And I went to South Carolina for 2 weeks. And I know nothing nor remember anything about what happened during that time except one thing that stood out very strongly, and that is in the midst of that two-week blackout that I had, I resigned my position as the pastor of that church. Woke up one morning, found this letter, you know, it was a very lovely letter, admitting my sins and my wrongs and everything else, you know, and that I did not feel that I was worthy anymore to serve in that kind of a position. So I quit. And I didn't know what to do beyond that. So what do? You're 48 years old. You're not working. You don't have a family anymore because you left them and all that kind of stuff. You know what I did? I went home to mommy. The long umbilical cord, I guess, you know. I went home to mom, and my mom and dad, you know, they always took care of me. They never hollered at me or anything like that. You know, they just gave me that look that people give you, you know, when things aren't right. And on the 25th day of May, I went out and I had two or three beers, which was highly unusual. I cooked some steaks, which is my favorite, and I didn't eat them. But instead I went to bed, and I stayed in the basement of my parents' home. And it was moldy, and it was dank, and it was humid, and things like that. And the next morning was a Sunday morning, and it was time for me, because I never missed church, drunk or not. And I said, I need some help. Well, they obliged, and they put me in the treatment center. I was one of the first preachers years ago that got hauled away for treatment, which I thought was a pretty big honor. And I went there to the Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And the first thing they told me when I went in there is the chaplain looked at me, and he said, you know, you don't have a conscience. And I thought to myself, well, now, who are you to judge? How do you know? Who made you God? Who do you think you're talking to? Don't you realize who I am? I spent 21 days there. The first thing they did, they locked me up in this special room with drug addicts. Not the alcoholics, but the people that had problem with drugs. And I thought to myself, why am I here? And I remember, you know, that one of the things that really scared me is that one of the young guys came up to me and said, look here, fella. He said, you know, you need to understand, I'm running the place. You mess around with me, I'll cut your balls off. And I thought, whoa, you know, no. You're not gonna I hid in the room. I stayed in the back room there, boy. I'm not going to mess around with those kind of people. And one of the most humiliating experiences of my life was when my aged parents came to that unit, and they brought their son, their drunken preacher son. Toilet articles. And I remember the look on their face, you know, when they saw that the door was locked and they had permission to come in, they had to sign in, and all kinds of things like that. And you would think that after all of the stuff that had happened, you know, a person would get sensible, but that isn't the way it happened. And I learned a long time ago that even after you quit drinking, and that there's just some brain dysfunction there, that we still keep acting like we used to, and we still make the crazy mistakes and things like that. But anyhow, during the time that I was there, it was a couple of days later, I started feeling pretty good. I had a great time while I was there. I thought the counselors were stupid. I thought that nobody really knew what they were talking about. I thought that most of the people and the stories they told there were just making them up, and they're out of their minds and so forth. But anyhow, I spent my time there, I did my time, and then when I left, the counselor took me in his office, and here's what he said. You know, the staff has just had a meeting about you, and we think that you're zany. And I thought to myself, well, you can't talk to me like that. I mean, zany means just slightly crazy. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to put up with this crap. I went to the library and looked up the word zany in the dictionary. And it does describe a person who's kind of a little bit off track, you know. But it also says it's somebody who brings excitement, enthusiasm, exuberance into the lives of other people. And I thought, my gosh, they recognize that I'm here. I thought, this is wonderful. This is terrible. The people told me, you know, you are the philosopher of X group. And I belong to X group out of X, Y, and Z. And I thought to myself, well, what a wonderful compliment. They really appreciate my being here. But what I found out is that isn't what they meant at all. And I can best illustrate by telling you a simple little story about a couple of ladies who got together for the 25th class reunion. One of them was really dolled up. It's obvious that she had been very successful, financially wise and so forth. The other one was dressed rather plainly. And they got to talking back and forth. And the one that looked like she was real fancy said, you know, do you know what my husband did for me when we got married? No. Well, as a wedding present, he bought me this 17-room house. I have servants and everything. That lady said, that's fantastic. She said, for a honeymoon, he took me on a 3-week cruise in the Mediterranean. The other gal said, fantastic. Look at the rock. Showed this big diamond to her. Said, he just gave me that as a present for my birthday. And she said, well, that is fantastic. And the conversation changed in the other way. And this gal said to the girl, it was rather plain, your husband did anything special for you? She said, yes, he did. He sent me to charm school. And she said, well, what did you learn at charm school? Well, she said, I learned to say fantastic instead of bullshit. I don't know if they had my number or not. They must have been going there and so forth and so on. They also said, when I left there, we want you for research. And I thought, this is really great. You know, in spite of everything that's happened, you know, they're going to write a book about this. I'm going to be able to help millions of people throughout the world and so forth and so on. Well, they sent there, went the taping and the questions. They took me up one side and down the other. And I thought, man, this is great. I'll never have to work again as long as I live. I'll live off the royalties. And nothing ever happened. I've never heard a word about that since then. So I lived through that period of this grandiosity, and even though I wasn't drinking and I was getting help and so forth and so on, I still had the big problem. I couldn't get rid of the ego and the fact that I was really the center of the universe and that people ought to recognize that and so forth. Anyhow, when I left there, here's what they told me. Now, Russell, you're going to have to go to 3 AA meetings a week. So I thought, well, you know, I'm out of a job. I'm not doing anything. That's not a big problem. In the Chicago area at that time, there were 525 different meetings in that whole big area there. And they said, you got to go to 3. Now, I believe with all of my heart that God was the instigator of all this. Because the 3 meetings that I picked were all step meetings. My recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is based on the 12 steps. And what I found out is that the 12 steps had taught me something I never knew before, that there are three things you have to work with in your life. There's God, there's self, and there's others. And if you look at the 12 steps, it is beautifully designed for that whole purpose. 1, 2, and 3, get ready. 4 and 5, do yourself. 6 and 7, do the God thing. 8 and 9, take care of others. And then 10, 11, and 12, keep what you've been given. So I learned how to get those three things together in my life. I still have problems, just like everybody else does. But you know, there was one thing that happened there, is that it took that ego down just a little bit. And every time I applied myself with sincerity and honesty in working those steps, it took a little bit of the ego down, a little bit. And I began to realize that things were important. When I went to those meetings, I remember that I didn't want to sit in the circle with the rest of them because I thought I was a little beyond them. And then one time, a little old plumber who came directly from his place of work, smelled in the high heavens, dirty as you could be, he's sitting around there. He looked at me, with my collar on, of course, and he said, you know, Reverend, you ought to get down off your high horse and come down here and join the rest of us, and you'll be a lot more comfortable. And I thought, well, what does he know? He's just a plumber, and I'm the preacher. He was right. I got down where the rest of them are, and the greatest friends and the greatest people in the world are the people who are down there where everybody else is, where we have a commonality of purpose, where we have a desire. And what I learned to do is that I learned kind of how to love things and to be a different person. And I started to learn that you can't fly a kite without a string. And I learned that you can't play, steer a ship without a rudder. And AA and the 12 steps has given me the something that I needed probably more than anything else in my whole life. So some wonderful things started to happen. I started to feel better. And you know what thought occurred to me? I'll bet you that Barbara would be glad to see me. Now, just to show you that, she's no dummy, while I was in treatment, she sold everything I owned. Had a 3-day garage sale, sold everything I owned. When I got out, I had some books left, and I had some clothes. That was it. She took the 3 younger children, rented a couple U-Hauls, and she moved out to New Richmond, Ohio, and moved into a little shack on the tributary of the Ohio River. And I thought to myself, you know, I bet she'd be glad to see me. Because she told me, if you just quit drinking, everything would be fine. Well, I wasn't drinking. So I tracked her down, like the old detective, you know. I found out where she was, and I remember knocking on the door. And she came to the door, and she looked at me, and she said, can we help you? I thought, my God, something is wrong with this woman. And I told her, I said, you know, you ought to be ashamed of yourself that you would bring my children into living in a place like this. And she said, it's better than the dump you left us in. I stayed there for a little while. In 15 minutes, I had talked my way back into the house and thought things were pretty good. She kicked me out 3 times because I wasn't conforming to her policies. And each time what I did, I'd take the Bank America card and the car, and I'd drive out to the West Coast. I'd send her the bills. Now, I'll just show you, I'm still good at this. I got to the point, she couldn't afford to kick me out anymore. So she kept me. And I remember that somebody asked her one time, you know, why did you stay with this guy? You know what she said? Habit. Wow. Habit. A great, marvelous, wonderful thing happened to both of us. We had no social life. There was hardly any money. You know what we did? We went to meetings. I invited her one time to come with me because I knew they had this place called Al-Anon, and she went to that meeting, and the first night that she went to that meeting out there, she came out and she was a changed person. My gosh. I used to tell her, I said, you know what your problem is, Barbara? And I was thinking, you bitch, you don't know, you haven't forgiven me yet. And she went to that meeting, you know, and somebody told her that, well, if he says that, why don't you just say, I'm sorry, you feel that way. So that's what she did. And I've never said anything about that since then. But what I have learned, I want to tell you, I will pay special tribute to Al-Anon at any time, anywhere, any place, in the grandest and the most eloquent words that you could find in the English language. The change that came in that woman was absolutely marvelous. Is spectacular, to say the least. And what I liked about that is I learned all these cute little sayings. Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. Well, you know you're saying that doesn't make it true. Well, you know you may be right. You know, and boy, I thought, goodness, I'm thinking, keep going to those meetings, babe. Don't give up now, because you're doing real good. And I had a wonderful time with her because I thought that was really great. I am married today to this woman. She is still with me. And in a few months, we will celebrate 54 years of married life. Okay? And she is probably, she is the most spectacular woman I ever met in my life. And everything that we've gone through, has fashioned both of us into people who have learned how to love and how to live. And I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous because it taught me how to live and how to love again. I never knew that. And she thanks Al-Anon, you know, for teaching her how to live and how to love again. So in spite of everything that happened, that we can look back and today, we laugh just like we did here this morning about some of that stuff that was going on. She's the greatest woman I ever met in my life. And I hope that I have many more years together with her. Let me tell you what I've learned how to do. I have learned how to treat Barbara with love because it's based upon a healthy respect for her as a person and as a special gift that God has put in my life. I treat her with that dignity because she certainly deserves that because she acts that way. And it's not that I have to play any games anymore like we used to play. We don't talk to each other anymore about what we think. You know why? Because I know what she thinks. She knows what I think. But what we do share are the wonderful feelings because that's who we are. And that's who everybody in this room is. You are your feelings. And when you don't express that, then you stuff it down inside and it becomes a dangerous problem or it can become one. So I've learned how to be able to do that and to enjoy that in the greatest thing. So I learned that AA is a community of action, not just talk. And I've tried my best over the years to do that. I went to 6 or 7 AA meetings for the first 10 years of my sobriety because that's exactly what I needed. And each time I went, things just got a little bit clearer, a little bit more open for me, a little bit challenging, a little bit happier and so forth. I learned that every bird has to whistle through his own beak. And that the most important thing that I had to do was to learn how to change my attitude. My attitude was selfish and self-centered. And I remember what it says in the big book, you know, and I believe that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our troubles. Above all else, we must deal with this selfishness. We must or it kills us. But God will help us to deal with that. And he did. I read a fascinating story about changing your attitude and it made a lot of sense to me. And it was about a big 6'8" Texan, weighed about 280, and he met this little brunette, about 5'2" tall, and he fell madly in love with her, and he proposed to her, and they got married. He was well-to-do, rented a honeymoon suite in the nearby town, and when the reception was over, they helicoptered over there, and they got up there in that honeymoon suite. He went in the bathroom to get ready to do what you're supposed to do on your wedding night. Came out with his big pair of blue jeans, threw them at her and said, "Put those pants on." And she goes down there and says, "I can't wear these pants." And he said, "As long as you remember that, we'll get along fine. I'm going to wear the pants in this family." Well, not to be outdone, she went in the bathroom to get ready, came out with this little pair of panties. And she flipped them at him and said, "Put those panties on." And he said, "I can't get in these panties." And she said, "If you don't change your attitude, you never will." My God. Now, that made sense to me. So if you want to be happy, joyous, and free, you change your attitude. And some things work out pretty good. Okay. Well, I was unemployed for 20 months, and my wife was very unhappy about the fact that I didn't work, and she'd come and complain about that, so I'd quote her the unemployment statistics, which were pretty high at that time. And she would say, you know, you need to get to work and take care of your family. I said, look, you don't understand. I belong to this organization. They told me to take it easy. They said, easy does it. And I'm not supposed to put a lot of undue pressure upon myself. But anyhow, after I was out of the ministry for about 20 months. And I remember that in order to get back in, or at least to start the process, I had to go talk to this preacher. And he was a counselor for fallen clergy, lived in the town of Cincinnati. And I remember going up to him and talking to him one Saturday morning. We sat there and he asked me all kinds of questions about life and all that. And I thought, Jesus, why is he doing this? Well, he's done. He said, I'll be back shortly. He went in the other room. I don't know what he did, but he came back and he told me, Russ, you're not going to make it. You're not going to get back. And I was really depressed. You know, I was really down. I was out and so forth. But I remember that nothing happens by accident. And 2 weeks later, I got a call to a church in Erlangen, Kentucky. I got a call to a church in Enterprise, Alabama. Barbara and I talked about this, and you know, at this point, we had come to the terms of her being a part of this life, too. And we agreed that we would take the call to this church down in Enterprise, Alabama. The Saturday before we left, I drove past that preacher's house, and I shot him a bird. He didn't understand the organization I belonged to. That AA does wonderful things, you know, and it does great things for people like us and so forth. I think AA has taught me to feel here that there is a God and I'm not Him. And that's something I had to learn over the years because I really felt that I had taken advantage of that position that I had for so long. I know that God's not going to do for me today what I can do for myself, but I do know that He will do for me what I can't, and that is to give me the one thing that I most desperately need in this life to be this happy, joyous, and free person, and that is to have a power from outside myself, a power that's greater than me. I have that today because I have the faith, and I have the confidence, and I have the trust that the people in this program have helped to instill in me. And my relationship with God is better than ever. My relationship with my wife is so much better. It reminds me of the story of a couple who fought for years, for about 40 years. They hardly ever talked to each other. And their names were Sven and Olga. And they were chatting, finally started to talk, and Olga said to Sven one day, you know, Sven, we can't continue to live this way. We need to ask God to take one of us away in death, and then I'll go live with my sister. Yeah, we don't do that anymore. I don't pray that God would take her. So mine basically is the story of a God who, in His grace. And I use that term because last Sunday when I delivered a message, the sermon was Something is Missing. And it reminded me of what was missing in my life. You know what it was? It was grace. The undeserved kindness that only God can bestow upon us and give each one of us. And I got that. But it was the grace that allowed this preacher to go to the very edges and the depths of a living hell. And then he snatched me back. Before it was too late. And He gave me the power and the strength, and He allowed His wife and children to love Him again, you know, and to keep Him and to respect Him and to honor Him as a provider and to love Him just as a person, as a human being, and so forth. But I think, but above all, God has allowed me to be happy today and not sad, to be positive rather than being negative all the time, and to be productive instead of being lazy. AA has done for me what alcohol used to do, and I don't have any of the hangovers. I don't have any of the withdrawals or anything like that. It is absolutely great. I learned to know myself, and I'm glad that I did, because I think that like all of you, deep down, we're some pretty special people. And if we could take ourselves apart underneath all of this surface and the veneer, we would find people who are very loving and tender and compassionate and sensitive and all the good stuff that goes there. But we put so much crap on top of there in life and allowed that to happen. So little by little, AA helps us to pull those things out of there. And the first thing you know, all the good stuff begins to come to the surface. And I think that that's great. My sponsor told me years ago that, Russ, we have a hell of a program, an H of a program, and I believe him because it's a very powerful thing. First of all, we have honesty. There's nothing greater than the whole world to be honest with yourself, and that's where it all starts. When I'm honest with myself, I'm honest with God. When I'm honest with myself, I can be honest with you, and I can say things exactly the way they need to be said and do it in the right way. We've been given the gift of humility. And that's what I needed probably more than anything else. First of all, I could recognize my own limitations today. I can't be everything to everybody, but I can be a lot of things to a lot. And that's a gift that we all have. I think that being a humble person is recognizing where it all comes from. It's a gift of God that's given to us so freely without any strings attached. It's yours. Take it, use it, enjoy it. And I think humility is also being real sensitive to the needs of other people. And a lot of us in our alcoholism never did that. We thought only of ourselves. And now we begin to realize, you know, our families have a right to hurt. They have a right to express their feelings too. They have a right to be a part of what's important in this life. So I was the prodigal son that was lost and now has been found. I was the prodigal who was dead, but now he is alive again, and he seems to be doing quite well than he ever was before. I'm willing to be teachable today, and that guarantees me that I can still continue to grow, and I can still continue to enjoy what I have. I learned that you never purify the water just by priming the pump. You got to work the handle to get the water up to where it's valuable. And today I can afford to let God be God. I want to tell you all, publicly, from the highest mountaintop, that I am willing to let God be the Father, and I'm willing to be the child. And He treats me that way. When I'm one of God's kids, that's exactly the way that thing works. For me, that's progress. We also have the gift of humor. Now, some of you may not believe this, but I'll tell you what. I told you I was old, the craziest drunk you ever saw in your life when I drank, because I never knew what I'd do. But I used to put those beautiful gowns on that I was telling you about when I was drunk. I'd put those on and dress up, and I'd get on my bicycle and ride around town. And then I heard that the cops found out about some guy driving around town in his nightgown. So I quit. I wasn't going to get caught with that kind of stuff there. But we laugh today. There's also a thing that is called humanity. People today call me Russ, among other things. And what's really interesting is that years ago, I would never allow anybody to call me anything but Pastor. And if they did, I'd take them off to the side and get them straightened out. Thank you so much for giving me my name back. It means the world to me today. Okay, I've learned also a little bit about humanity. I've learned how to say shit and stuff like that, you know, some of those old French words a lot of people use today. And I do that without having to say, gosh, I need to be flogged because I did that. In this program, there's another H that is called hope. There's hope for everyone. You know, every day that we have little downtime in our life, there's always hope. And we hold on to that, and we grab on to that, and we do what God has taught us to do through this program. And we go and we share with each other, and we listen to each other, and we practice with each other. And that hope remains alive, and that's a great thing. And there's a thing that is called help. Anybody that wants help can have it. Anybody that wants it can have it. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you today is that some great and wonderful things have happened. My life has not been wasted. There were 20 years of addictive drinking where I messed up a lot of things and so forth. But things have gotten pretty well back. So Oliver Wendell Holmes once made this statement, which I think is really significant. He said that most people die with their music still in them. And I want to say to everybody here today that you and I belong to an organization that has the grandest symphony in all the world. Don't die with your music in you. You have the chance to reach out and to share with other people, and I encourage you to do that. So let me close with a little story about a couple grasshoppers. Not the kind you drink, though. About these two grasshoppers that fell in the bowl of thick, rich cream. And the first grasshopper fell in there, and he said, "Oh my gosh," he said, "I'm in a mess. This is terrible. I've never been in a predicament like this. Oh my goodness, I don't know what to do." And he just kept going on and on, living in self-pity about his problem. And guess what? The first thing you know, he drowned in that bowl of thick, rich cream. And the second grasshopper fell in that bowl of thick, rich cream, and he said, "Holy smokes, am I ever in trouble? Man, I better do something fast, or I'll never get out of this thing alive." And so he began kicking up his little grasshopper heels and singing his little grasshopper song. First thing you know, he turned that cream into solid butter, and he walked away to safety. And I want to say that I believe that that is the choice that Alcoholics Anonymous gives all of us today. If you want, you can be like the first one. And you can feel sorry for yourself. And you can be miserable. And you can be sad. And you can just, mess up your whole life. Or you can be like grasshopper number two. You kick up your little AA heels and sing the beautiful symphony of the 12 steps. And first thing you know, it turns those old shaky legs into solid underpinnings. And you start walking one step at a time, one day at a time, until the day that God takes you away from this life. And in the process, you have this promise that you will be happy and you will be joyous and you will be free. We all have that choice today. I like grasshopper number two. So my closing prayer, let's end some. Hold me close, God. Let your love surround me. Bring me near and draw me to your side. And as I wait, I'll rise up like an eagle and I will soar with you. Your spirit leads me on in the power of your love. So God did this for me. And now I need to do what he's given me to do. Thanks very much. Appreciate being here.